Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Elizabeth J. Bergman. Bergman is an assistant professor at Ithaca College's Gerontology Institute. She received her PhD in aging studies from the University of South Florida. Her areas of teaching and scholarship include families and aging, sociology of aging, hospice care, Alzheimer's, and end-of-life issues. And I welcome you to the show, Elizabeth. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I'd like to begin with a bit about what it was that attracted you to the study of gerontology in the first place.
That's a really common question that I get.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for asking. When I was very young, started playing the violin in the public school in a Suzuki violin group. And one of the things that we did on a regular basis was to visit retirement communities, assisted living facilities, and nursing homes and perform. And I found that I just naturally gravitated towards older people. You know, you hear from a lot of people that they wanted to teach because they loved children. I just found that I loved older people and being around them and learning from them. I didn't realize, though, that you could study gerontology
uh-huh.
in a formal kind of way until I was almost finished with a bachelor's degree in psychology and
wow.
then began to explore gerontology.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Now, you know, we have better diets, medical advances, especially here in the West. Has gerontology, you know, changed its parameters in regard to old age and aging at this point?
Or
has it stayed pretty much the same?
No, absolutely. It's expanding all the time to,
mm-hmm.
to focus on all kinds of areas. And more so recently, opportunities and the positive sides of aging. You know, we used to focus so much on just the negative aspects of aging, and more we're focusing on the opportunities for creativity and expression and other positives of aging, which is really exciting.
That is. People are definitely living longer, and so tell us what the societal implications are of that. People living, you know, unhealthy longer in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of them. I mean, there are sort of the obvious things that we think of in terms of implications of population aging on Social Security and Medicare and the sustainability of Medicaid and other policies for older people. But there are also the issues of this whole group of people approaching old age without the financial resources to do that. And these are people who are likely to live into their 90s and beyond. There are a number of workforce issues. A lot of people today in their 50s and 60s, in fact, I read a statistic recently that about 70% of people in their 50s and 60s who are approaching retirement say that they plan to or expect that they will need to work into their 70s and beyond. There is a shortage of geriatricians and other healthcare professionals to provide services for older people, healthcare services, and a dramatic shortage of nurses' aides and other kinds of healthcare professionals to provide care, particularly in facilities. There are issues around family caregiving.
I was going to bring that up because there's been so many changes in family structure and what makes a family in this day and age.
Absolutely.
So talk to us a little bit about the challenges.
Well, there's a host of challenges associated with family caregiving. And first, I should mention that the statistic is that about 20% of all adults in this country are providing unpaid care to either a family member or increasingly to close friends or other members of their community. And they face a lot of challenges. They face challenges associated with directly providing the care, things like lifting and helping to make sure that older people that they're caring for eat the right foods and have food to eat,
mm-hmm.
have food
mm-hmm.
in the refrigerator, et cetera. They also face challenges associated with sort of secondary stressors, things like financial challenges that they face because they've had to take time out of the workforce or because they've had to cut back on the number of hours that they're working or are providing resources to somebody that they're caring for that they can't then use for other purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, for family caregivers, life goes on. You know, there are all of the other sort of chronic life stressors and things that we face. I was talking to a dear friend of mine just the other night who is a caregiver for a friend of hers who has Alzheimer's disease.
Mm.
And she was talking about how, in addition to all of the things that she's doing in her role as a caregiver, the grants at work are still due and the personnel issues and things still happen. And when these stresses kind of compound, it can have real implications.
Are we finding that older people who may be disabled or just in need of assistance are choosing to stay at home?
Yeah.
Or or yeah. Is it because they can't financially afford to go into assistant living?
No, people want to stay at home. People want to age in place. They want to stay in the homes that they've been in for many years. That's the view. That's probably going to continue. And we as family members want to make that possible for people. And as people develop chronic diseases and need even very intense levels of care, they still want to be home. In fact, 80% of people say that they want to die at home, surrounded by their friends and loved ones.
Yeah, I've never heard anybody say, I want to die in a rest home, I must admit.
No, or a hospital.
Or a hospital. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the issue that has been dominating the news of late, and that is Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
We don't seem to have come up with any solutions to any aspect of it. So talk to us a little bit about what's going on in regard to, you know, cures and care of people with Alzheimer's.
Well, that's a broad topic.
It is.
And a lot to say. There are 5.3 million people in the United States with Alzheimer's. One in eight people 65 years of age and older have Alzheimer's disease.
That's amazing, isn't it?
One in two people age 85 and older have Alzheimer's disease, are at some stage of the disease. And I should point out that a lot of people who have Alzheimer's disease are in the early stages. They can still have a very high quality of life. They can still have control over the things that happen to them and take a lot of joy in their family relationships and activities and things that are going on. We have a long ways to go in terms of curing this disease. We need to put a lot of money and a lot of effort. We need to get our best and brightest the resources that they need, really, to do the research to find a cure for the disease.
Yeah.
You know, we have medicine.
We've had some disappointments of late, too.
We have, indeed. We have medicines that can slow the progression of the disease, but there is no cure.
Now, Alzheimer's, a lot of people think of Alzheimer's as some kind of separate entity, but it is just one of the stages of dementia that older people and young people can go through. Is that correct?
It is. In the classroom, I explain to students sort of what Alzheimer's is in relation to dementia. And I use the analogy of dementia is to Alzheimer's disease as soup is to Campbell's chicken noodle. you know, Alzheimer's is one variety of dementia, dementia being a broad category of disorders. Alzheimer's disease is by far the most common dementia, and we're finding more and more, as you've mentioned, that Alzheimer's disease is not always experienced sort of exclusively. It's sometimes experienced along with other conditions that can make treatment really complicated.
Do we think that more and more people are coming down with Alzheimer's, or was it just not designated that in the early days?
I don't really know the answer to that question. Definitely, we didn't know as much about Alzheimer's disease. We didn't know to diagnose the disease, and so some people who had Alzheimer's disease didn't ever get the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
We do think, though, that the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease is increasing.
I know you've done quite a bit of research about how this disease affects the caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about how caregivers can take care of themselves while dealing with this with a loved one.
It's challenging. One of the main things that caregivers can do is to reach out and ask for help, to identify the areas where they could use assistance, to identify potential sources for assistance, either other members of the family or other members of the community, or if they have the resources to be able to private pay for services to help them in their role as a caregiver. Those are some things that caregivers can do.
Mm-hmm. And are services readily available to people without a lot of resources?
Well,
or is that still a challenge?
Services are available, definitely. And if anyone's listening who is interested in locating those services, the first place that I would direct them to is the local office for the aging or area agency on aging in their community. Each county has an office for the aging in the state of New York, and they have an elder helpline, a telephone number that you can call and get access to and referrals to services that are available to them.
Have you been touched personally by anybody with Alzheimer's?
I have.
Really?
I have.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us a little bit about the experience?
My grandmother on my father's side died of dementia, whether it was Alzheimer's or vascular dementia related to strokes at the time wasn't necessarily a very clear-cut thing, and we don't necessarily know, as is the case for so many people. My husband's grandmother, the same exact kind of situation.
And you notice personality changes and inability to perform tasks that were once really familiar,
absolutely.
Right? I mean, then those are the trajectories of these diseases.
Absolutely, and confusion and frustration and anger associated with those.
And on the part of probably the person who's watching the person go downhill, right?
Yeah.
Lots of guilt
absolutely.
And anger. And
absolutely. In my case, my father, who was an only child, was caring for his mother long distance. He lived 1,200 miles away and would fly there as frequently as he could to arrange for services and provide care and do the hands-on things that he needed to do. But I don't think he's ever used the word guilt, but to watch him from a distance try to be everything that he wanted to be for her was really, really a challenge.
Yeah. I actually got a shock a few years ago when I had a friend who was working at an assistant care home as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And she met a man who was only in his early 40s,
yeah.
Bart, who had Alzheimer's. I had never heard that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing that people probably don't know, that really can start happening much younger than we think.
It really can. Early onset Alzheimer's disease is increasingly recognized as an issue, although we should point out that that's a rare condition, and that early onset Alzheimer's disease is much more genetically linked than is the later onset.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about end-of-life issues. You said that achieving a good death is sometimes difficult in this country. Talk to us about that.
Well, in the 1960s, there was a psychiatrist by the name of Avery Weissman who started thinking about and talking about sort of aspects of an appropriate death, that being the kind of death that we would wish for ourselves. And so began sort of this constantly evolving list of characteristics of things that describe a good death and the kinds of things that terminally ill patients say that are among their top priorities. Those are things like reduction, obviously, of physical, emotional, and social pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Those are among the highest priorities. But also the continuation of fulfilling relationships and the reduction of conflict in relationships that may not be as fulfilling. The fulfillment of prevailing wishes, things that we always wanted to do but never got an opportunity. Being mentally aware is really important to a lot of people at the end of life.
Yeah.
And also not feeling like they're being a burden on other people. Those are really things that people say that they want. And as I mentioned, 80% of people say that they want to die at home, surrounded by loved ones, family members. 75% of us, though, die in a hospital setting.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
That is amazing.
It is. It's unfortunate. And in a lot of ways, it's indicative of the fact that we're failing people at the end of life. And we need to change the way that we do things.
Now, why do you think we're failing people? Is it because we are capable of extraordinary measures now medically to try to keep people alive?
Well, we are, and we're kind of enchanted with those measures. We have so many technologies and interventions and surgeries and procedures and things that we can do to try to stave off death, and we're enchanted with those. And so, also, the way that the healthcare system is structured, we physicians and other healthcare providers are reimbursed for example, the procedures that they do, the surgeries that they do. Mm-hmm. They're not reimbursed for the time that they spend talking with a patient about what it would mean to not do the surgery, or to then maybe follow up by telephone or Skype with a family member or something long distance about, okay, so if we decide not to do this invasive procedure or intervention or whatever, what does that mean? And what are your expectations for what the future holds then?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Professor Elizabeth J. Bergman. She's an assistant professor at the Gerontology Institute at Ithaca College. Now do you think that some of this intervention and so on is because of a denial of death? I mean, are we afraid to even admit that we are going to lose people?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're afraid to even talk about the fact that we're aging, not to mention the fact that we're going to die. And part of it, too, though, is that it's hard to know sometimes when we're close to death. Some conditions, particularly the long progressive kinds of diseases like Alzheimer's disease, for example, it's really hard to know when the end is very close.
Yeah.
Even conditions like cancer that tend to lend themselves to easier prognostication sometimes don't happen the way we think they're going to happen.
Yeah, and we all also we want to keep each other comfortable when we're dying of these horribly painful diseases. So that mental clarity issue is a hard thing to balance as well. I mean, people are not necessarily mentally clear when they're on morphine.
Right. Absolutely.
So those are some of the dilemmas. I know you worked at a hospice.
I did.
As a volunteer. Tell us about that experience. That has changed some of this in regard to how we die.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It has. When I first began my graduate work in gerontology, my first semester I took a class called Death and Dying. Mm. That was a really life-changing class for me. And one of the things that I decided to do based on my experience in that class was to become a hospice volunteer. This was in Tampa, Florida. I went to the hospice organization, went through a amazing training that hospices nationwide offer to volunteers, and became what was called a patient care volunteer. I was matched with hospice patients, and I would go to their homes or to the facility where they were living, or at that time there wasn't a hospice house, but a lot of hospices now have hospice houses where some patients live. And I would be with that person in whatever capacity was most useful or meaningful to them. In some cases, it was just sitting and shooting the breeze. In other cases, it was taking the grocery list and going to the store and getting the things that they needed. In other cases, it was sitting at the bedside and reading to a person who wasn't able to read for themselves. In many cases, it was staying in the home with the person who was receiving hospice care while the caregiver could go out and get a haircut or go to the bank or do whatever it is that they needed to do, or just go have dinner with their friends.
Yeah, yeah. That must teach you how rich life is, just ordinary experiences, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything about it was a life-changing experience, and just the degree of intimacy that you experience as a result of being let into people's lives at that difficult time in their life was really amazing.
Toward the end. Do they still teach Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work? I know when I was a kid, she was a pioneer.
She was a pioneer. She absolutely is a pioneer, and we do teach Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And there is a lot that we draw from her work that still applies. One of the things that's changed is that we now realize that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief aren't, that we still experience aspects of those stages.
Yeah, denial and all those things.
Anger, bargaining, depression, and ultimately acceptance. Mm-hmm. We still experience aspects of those stages of grief, but they're not sequential necessarily. We're not all going to start with denial and end with acceptance and go through them in that order. And they're not all universal. Some of us are going to experience aspects of denial and nothing else. Other people are going to experience aspects of two or three of those stages, maybe not in order, but not all of them. So
yeah. I've known people who only experience the anger part,
yeah,
especially when they die young.
So have I.
Yeah, a lot of people I've known who've died of AIDS.
Yeah.
People often suffer from depression when they're having to deal with people who are dying or the people who are dying. How do you talk about that in your classrooms?
Do you mean
the depression
professions involve
dealing with people who are sick and dying? Yeah, and family members who are dealing with this, you know, the sick and dying loved one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a very, very common problem, as are other mental health kinds of conditions like anxiety and grief. And there are a number of resources available for people who are in that position and who are experiencing some of those negative outcomes. There are support groups, both for people who are family caregivers, but also for people who've lost that role and are now experiencing bereavement and grief. There are counseling programs. Hospice, in many communities, including the local community, provides bereavement services not just to patients and families who received hospice care, but to the community at large. So people who are experiencing depression or other negative outcomes can look to hospice for assistance, regardless of whether or not their loved one died under hospice care.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good resource to know about. Now you teach as an assistant professor at the Gerontology Institute at Ithaca College. What kinds of careers are people looking for when they take classes from you?
There's a whole range. We get a number of people who actually major in gerontology or aging studies, and those folks are going to go out in a whole lot of different capacities and work with older people. Some of them are going to manage facilities. Some of them are going to be administrators of assisted living facilities or nursing homes or other sort of residential communities where older people live. Other people are going to manage social services and other social programs and community programs for older people. Some are going to be involved in recreational activities and leisure programming for older people. Those are some examples of the kinds of fields. Other people are going to be in health professions, and they're going to interact predominantly with older people. And so they may be majoring in, say, physical therapy or occupational therapy, and complement that education with some courses in gerontology to prepare them for working primarily with the older adult population.
Mm-hmm. Through the years, there have always been reports of really bad assisted living homes, really bad rest homes. Have we made any headway on that?
We have.
Have we?
The squeaky wheel gets the grease. We hear about the bad ones, and there are definitely bad ones out there. But I always call attention to the fact that there are so many good facilities for older people, facilities that are doing so many things right and doing a lot with the resources that they do have. And there's a whole range. There are facilities that only accept, say, Medicaid funding and provide housing for the lowest income individuals, and all the way up to facilities that cost $10,000 and $15,000 a month to live in. There's a huge range out there.
Yeah. Now you teach a course called Sociology of Aging. Tell us a little bit about what that entails.
That's a really fun class, and we get to sort of examine the way in which aging impacts society and the way in which society impacts aging. So we look at a lot of the images that we're exposed to in the media and the information that we get about aging from our society and analyze whether that whether those messages are positive or negative or necessarily accurate and where the biases are. We also look at issues related to population aging, both in the U.S. as well as globally. What kinds of implications is that going to have, and how can we cope with some of those issues?
I know a lot of older women who say that older women especially are invisible in this culture. Are you able to teach in these gerontology classes about sensitivity and not patronizing older people and all those stereotype things that I do hear happen in this culture all the time?
Absolutely. In Sociology of Aging, for example, we talk about compassionate ageism and how sometimes patronizing little old ladies isn't necessarily the right approach, even if our intentions are really good. That's not the way to approach older people.
Because this is a youth culture.
Oh, absolutely.
So it must be difficult to be teaching people how to deal with aging. I mean, like you said earlier in the show, people are in denial about even getting older.
Yeah, absolutely. We're in denial about getting older, you know, I think in part because of the messages that we see in the media and all the anti-aging sort of messages that we get, and we have a lot of misconceptions about what aging is going to mean for us. You know, we associate aging with decline and physical frailty and disease, and we don't necessarily think about the opportunities and the new challenges that come along with it and the freedoms of old age. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to talk about aging, I think, because if we talk about it, then we acknowledge that we're closer and closer to our own death every day.
Yeah, yeah. Do you compare cultures in some of your classes? Because I know aging is thought of differently, and in Asian cultures, there's a respect for elders. There's a whole tradition. I've lived in the Netherlands and parts of Europe, and they are so different about aging.
They are.
In different countries.
And we do that some, although I would certainly say that's not necessarily an area in which I would describe myself as an expert. I was having a conversation just this morning in my sociology of aging class with an older woman who talked about the fact that a team of Japanese researchers came to the retirement community where she was living about 6 years ago, trying to understand how they could create retirement communities and market retirement communities to Japanese elders who, in Japanese culture, they were just having no success at all at making retirement communities appeal to older people. So they were learning about how they could do that.
Because Japanese culture, they stay at home, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, the family takes care of each other.
Absolutely. There's a very clear sort of delineation of who's going to care for whom and how that's going to happen. And if you marry, you're to go live with your husband's parents and be responsible for their care. And
yeah, they probably don't even have a word for assisted living or rest home.
They may, but it's probably a relatively new word.
Now, has all this study that you've been on and the road you've been on with this career in gerontology, do you think it's prepared you better for getting older?
Yes and no.
Tell me.
I mean, I think that it's armed me with a lot of knowledge about perhaps the kinds of things that I might expect in my future, both positive and negative. And it's armed me with knowledge in terms of when I do find myself again in a caregiving kind of situation, where I can go for help and what questions are going to be most useful to pose and those kinds of things. But it's so interesting, and my colleagues and I frequently talk about this, when it happens to us in our own families, you know, when one of our parents faces the end of their life, and when we find ourselves being the one who's experiencing bereavement, for example, it's in many ways as if all the gerontological training that we have just kind of goes out the window.
Oh, I can understand that.
Yeah.
Well, Elizabeth, we only have about a minute left, and you wanted to talk a little bit about the Gerontology Institute's conference that's coming up the end of September?
I do. The Ithaca College Gerontology Institute is having their annual conference. It's on September 30th at Ithaca College. The keynote speaker is going to be Dennis McCullough, who is the author of My Mother, Your Mother, which is a book that talks about the concept of slow medicine, one of the new approaches to geriatric care that's really gaining some steam.
Oh, that's great. Also the memory walks. There are going to be many memory walks. Can you give a website where people can get information about that?
Absolutely. For families who are affected by Alzheimer's disease or people who want to participate in the memory walk or get connected with the Alzheimer's Association, the memory walk is a great way to do that. The website is alz.org/memory walk.
That's great. Well, Elizabeth Bergman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
We have run out of time. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.